This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Doctor in the House, brought to you by AIA Vitality.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It is the day before Ramadan and, of course, it's a Friday. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist in the studio with me. How
good
are you today,
Mira.
George?
I'm feeling great, yeah? Because the sun is shining and then actually the traffic is not too bad yet.
I know, but I'm a little concerned. I mean, Ramadan is tomorrow and the weather has been terribly hot. It's probably going to be quite a challenge. But then again, I suppose it doesn't really, shouldn't matter.
No. For urology, we're going to get influx of people with kidney stones and urinary tract infections.
Really, because that's you're right. Unable to drink water, I suppose.
That's correct.
Okay, yeah, and joining us today, Dr. Zanaria Hussain, consultant endocrinologist. How are you, Dr. Zanaria?
Fine, thanks. Nice to meet you both again, Mira and George.
And who do you see mostly during the month of Ramadan?
We see the usual diabetics, some thyroid patients, yeah. But we do get more admissions for diabetes-related problems like high sugars.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's the indulgence of buka puasa?
Yes, definitely.
Is it because of that?
In a way.
Okay. And not because you are unable to take your medication?
Medications need to be adjusted during Ramadan, and that's what is important. The doctors need to train the patients before that. But we do run into some problems, especially patients on insulin therapy and patients who are elderly. They do run into problems of extremes of glucose, yeah.
Okay. And George, you were saying kidney stones and urinary tract infections. Mm-hmm. Can you do anything about it? Because you can't drink water.
That's correct.
So what is a way around it?
Well, I mean, I always advise patients when booker, don't go for too salty food, and then also drink plenty of water when they have an opportunity to do so, and also eat fruit that actually can retain water, something like dates, and then, you know, they will help them to see through the days. And that's how people lived in, you know, Middle Eastern countries, you know. That's right. Mm-hmm. And then those sort of measures will really help them to prevent urinary tract infections.
Okay, I'm very curious as to what people have for saho nowadays. What do you have, Dr. Zanaria? I'm just very, very curious because, you know, back in the day, right, people would wake up and cook and all of that.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really have the luxury of time. I mean, you're tired, right?
I'm actually quite a light eater. It's just like having breakfast. So it may be a bit of quick oats and a bit of cereal, some eggs and coffee and the dates, of course. Mm-hmm. I think dates are very nutritious and gives you quite a bit of energy. So mine is rather simple.
Okay, I was just having a chat about dates with a colleague of mine just now. I mean, how many dates is acceptable? It is sweet.
Yes.
But how many? Because sometimes you can sit there going one after the other. Right. They're lovely.
Well, if you don't have diabetes, I guess it's not a big problem. But if you do have diabetes, it really can get your sugars up really, really quickly, mm-hmm, quite high. Mm. So, I mean, one or two dates at breaking of fast for a diabetic is acceptable. And I think for the rest of us, I think, you know, moderation is the key.
Yeah, well, there are the fruits as well. You know, something like apples, and guava, and then fruits like that will help as well.
Okay, all right then. So the reason we call Dr. Zanaria Hussain in today is because it's International Thyroid Awareness Week, mm-hmm, and we're turning our attention in particular to hypothyroidism. I mean, we do know that there are two types. One is hypo and one is hyper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you're wondering where your thyroid is actually a butterfly-shaped organ in the front of your neck. And I was, that's very general. And I was asking Dr. Zanaria, can you just show me exactly where this, the front of my neck is rather large.
Yes. Well, it's rather small gland. It's divided symmetrically into a right side and a left side, just like a butterfly. And the middle, there's a bridge of tissue called the isthmus. Just about maybe, if I quote the dimensions, each lobe is about 2 × 2 cm × 5 cm, so it's not really that big.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you can't really see it if it's not enlarged.
That's right. Yeah. That's, you know, so, in a medical school, you always get all these troops of patients who are professional patients who are brought in during the exams time where you can actually see it, and then you have to do a routine examination for the goiter.
What do you mean you can see it?
Right, okay. And it was like, for example,
you can see the butterfly.
You can see that Mira is consciously touching her neck.
I know. I'm like imagining a butterfly sticking out of here now.
Well, it can be enlarged generally, so you could see the butterfly shape, but sometimes it's just part of it that's enlarged, like a little ball or nodule.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a small one, which you can't see, but it could also be a bigger one.
So symptoms, is it always the fact that you can see it so you know something is not right, or you have a whole lot of other symptoms as well?
Well, if it's hypo or hyperthyroidism, that means the extremes of hormone, sometimes the thyroid is not actually enlarged.
Assuming that enlarged thyroid, the physically enlargement, doesn't necessarily mean that it's overactive or underactive. It's just termed as goiter. Is that correct?
Yeah. What is goiter?
It's just a general term for enlargement of the thyroid gland.
And there can be no reason for that.
There are many reasons to get a goiter.
And then so we're going to talk about a little bit of food as well that can induce goiter, right?
Yes. Yeah. All right. Why the focus on hypothyroidism? Even in the articles I was reading, seems to have more of an emphasis on hypo.
Hypothyroidism, because we feel that it's probably a little bit more common than hyperthyroidism, especially as people grow older. There's a tendency for most organs to sort of reduce in terms of functional ability. So most of the endocrine organs may face a bit of dysfunction as you get older. So there is a higher rate of low thyroid hormone or hypothyroidism as one ages. So in some countries, in fact, there is you do screen people for thyroid function after a certain age, but in Malaysia we don't. It depends on how common the disease is. We feel it's not as common as diabetes. Maybe, about hypothyroidism, maybe about 1-2% of the population. Mm-hmm. So,
Do we have much Malaysian statistics?
Before this, we don't have nationally representative statistics, but I'm glad to say MEMS, or the Malaysian Endocrine Metabolic Society, we've fully funded a research project. It's complete after 3 years. 2,200 individuals all over Peninsula Malaysia nicely sampled, and what we looked at is the occurrence of thyroid dysfunction by doing thyroid hormone levels from blood tests as well as thyroid antibodies. And we did, now for the first time we have some data. We haven't finalized a report, but it's looking almost like what we see overseas, but a little bit more hyperthyroidism, which caught us by surprise.
Yeah.
But the rates are still quite low, so we're seeing about 1-2% of population having hypothyroidism, and maybe up to 3-4% having hyperthyroidism. But what was obvious is that only maybe a quarter or a third is overt or having symptoms, and the other two thirds or almost three quarters are what we call so mild that they don't give symptoms. And it's this condition called subclinical. You only detect it because blood tests are abnormal.
I mean, clearly, as the president of Malaysian Endocrine and Metabolic Society, right? Okay, and then we are taking this opportunity. Yesterday was World Thyroid Day to kind of launch campaign for awareness and things. How important, with the statistic that you quoted, how important is awareness in Malaysia? And also, we obviously have got phone in from the listeners, and how do you think they can join the conversations to bring up this awareness?
Right. I feel the general awareness for thyroid disease is still rather low. I think we focused a lot on other non-communicable disease like, diabetes, high blood pressure, cholesterol, the heart. But the general awareness on hormone disorders is still rather low.
Yeah, I have to say we're guilty of that.
So, MEMS, or Malaysian Endocrine Metabolic Society, we've actually embarked on this public awareness campaign. It's in its third year since 2015, and it's called Transform Your Life. And it's a collaboration between MEMS, Ministry of Health Malaysia, as well as Merck. Merck is a pharmaceutical company that is a producer of thyroxine, which is the main therapy for hypothyroidism. This year being the third year, the feature or focus is on women and hypothyroidism.
Right.
Particularly important because women in their reproductive age, especially those that are trying to conceive, those that are pregnant, they are at risk of having hypothyroidism, which is quite common, and that can affect their, especially
fertility.
Fertility, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
And also in pregnancy, having low thyroid hormones can impact on the fetal outcome,
right.
Especially it's been found cognition and IQ of the baby and the the offspring may be affected.
You mentioned really kind of exciting subjects. I'm pretty certain that there will be some listeners calling into.
I think the disturbing thing is 2/3 of us don't know we are walking around.
That's right.
Subclinical, meaning borderline. Is it borderline subclinical or slightly higher?
The terminology is a bit confusing. Sometimes it's just it's interchangeable, mild, subclinical, borderline. Just to illustrate that it's not overt and does not really associate with any symptoms.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to go back many, many steps. Yeah. What is the function of the thyroid really?
Good idea.
What does it do?
That's right. Well, first of all, establish that butterfly. That's right. We talked about the butterfly in front of us. Sure the listeners want to know, what does it do?
The thyroid gland is so essential. It produces thyroid hormones. We have two main thyroid hormones, and the main component is iodine, and these thyroid hormones are so important for metabolism and affects every single organ of the body, the heart, the lungs, the gut, insulin production as well to some extent is also impacted by thyroid hormones.
It's like and the battery of the body, right? Yeah, kind of like inducing the
That's the mitochondria.
The mitochondria is within the cell.
Yeah.
The thyroid itself actually induces all the metabolic activities in your body.
Yeah.
So whenever you're too high, then your batteries crank up too much. You're too low, and then your battery is too low.
I see. That's right, in that sense.
Yeah. Okay.
All the cells in the body.
Mitochondria is the power bank, isn't it?
Power bank inside the cell.
Okay. Yeah. Do you see many men, George? Because this is very common amongst women. Hypothyroidism, very common amongst women. Do you see men?
Well, I see men. With erectile dysfunction, coming back to statistics, American Thyroid Association yesterday published figures to show that 12% of American men and women at some point in their life will have some form of thyroid conditions. 60% of them are completely unaware. Yeah. And women are 8 times more likely to get this condition. Yeah. And then so I'm going to ask Dr. Zara to tell us a little bit why women are more prone to it. But when men have this problem, they have problems with obesity, and then they have problems with putting on weight, high blood pressure, metabolic syndrome, and erectile dysfunction. And so it's a chicken and egg situation. And then, as a normal clinician, probably the last thing you think about is thyroid. However, obviously, if they go through the endocrinologist, the thyroid will be quite higher up on the list. Yeah. Would that be correct?
Yeah, second to diabetes, thyroid is the most common hormone problems, second to diabetes.
And also sometimes when you're fatigued, when you are losing weight or putting on weight, sometimes doctors just tell you it's your lifestyle, change your lifestyle. And you start to think, I'm not eating healthy, I am not exercising enough, when actually it is the thyroid indeed that's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, the difficult thing about thyroid disorders is most of the symptoms, in hypothyroidism especially, is non-specific.
Yeah.
So you get exactly the same symptoms in most of us, except in hypothyroidism, it may be a little bit more persistent and prolonged and protracted, progressive.
If you listen to the show last week we blamed our genes for putting on weight and then we had our gene analysed. This week we're going to blame the thyroid.
And confuse everybody more, isn't it? But hypothyroidism. I mean, one says you will put on weight, the other one says you lose weight. But then again, it can even with hypo, you can put on weight as well.
Put on weight.
Tendency to put on weight.
Yeah, hyper, you will lose weight. And then some people naughtily actually take extra thyroxine in order to lose weight.
Don't give us ideas.
No.
It's quite serious. And that brings up another subject of this indiscriminate prescription. Small doses of thyroid hormone for well-being and anti-aging, which is quite scary.
We'll come back up next and find out more about that.
Lots of questions
because especially when it has to do with weight loss, everybody starts to listen. If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 0377-109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 0162019000. Good afternoon. It's Health and Living, and I'm Meera Sivasothi. In the studio with me, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Dr. Zanaria Hussain, who is a consultant endocrinologist. She's also president of the Malaysian Endocrine and Metabolic Society. We're discussing hypothyroidism in particular today because it's International Thyroid Awareness Week. Plenty to talk about. We were talking about thyroxine, which is a medication used to manage thyroid levels if they do go up or go down, and the abuse of that. You want to tackle that, Dr. Zanaria?
As an endocrinologist, most of the time we use thyroxine for overt thyroid disease. So that means that, you know, patients do have symptoms and their blood tests actually confirm that their thyroid hormones are low and there is an etiology or a cause for having that, and therefore they need thyroxine replacement. Most commonly it's due to autoimmune disease, autoimmune failure, the antibodies that attack the thyroid, mostly in women in their 30s and 40s, and then they need. The other cause is thyroid surgery, removal of the thyroid gland for whatever cause, and also sometimes we use radioiodine therapy. So we would need thyroxine for that. And it's actually a synthetic form of thyroid hormone, exactly what we produce, but synthetic form. The other sort of area of concern that I've been seeing more often these days because we're a bit concerned about aging and about the fact that we're losing energy and having low mood, is whether the hormones coming down as you age may actually be responsible for that. And it could be thyroid hormone, it could be your pituitary hormone, growth hormone, or as George would actually focus on testosterone, or even
so it's a
estrogen.
Cocktail of all these, hormones that you deal with.
Yeah. Yes, George, is that there are some physicians or doctors out there who are measuring hormones in patients who are actually quite well. They're getting blood tests done and actually looking at the results and comparing it to the normal results, but actually expressing that there is a more normal than normal range.
So supra-physiological level.
And trying to get people in the older age group to the young normal range.
Uh-huh.
Prescribing very little doses of, bioidentical hormones is the name, because it's not the thyroxine that most of us doctors use. It's in fact bioidentical, and these are like nanogram, amounts of thyroid hormone.
All right.
And what I've seen is some patients get hyperthyroid.
That's right. So this is like, doctors induce hyperthyroid.
Yeah, and I'm very concerned about that, Meera and George.
Yeah.
I've only recently, just yesterday, saw a patient like that in clinic. And another patient I saw several weeks ago is a young woman who was trying her best to get pregnant and being told that, she may have some problems with her thyroid. And when I looked at the results, the panel of tests were absolutely normal.
Yeah.
But she was told that, it should be more normal.
Yeah, right.
And she was given some hormones and it didn't work out.
Yeah.
Oh, so I'm very concerned about
best that. Best case scenario, it doesn't work out. But worst case scenario, it might cause death, right?
These are such minute doses.
So you're not so worried.
For example, if you're elderly or you have some predisposition to cardiac arrhythmia, and also in the elderly having problems with bone loss and osteoporosis, getting your thyroid hormone levels high predispose you to cardiac or heart rhythm abnormalities, and also accelerates your bone loss as well.
But there must have been a reason why she was prescribed that.
Yeah, I think most...
What is the understanding?
Usually these are in the wellness situations of
age reversal
areas and wellness areas, and I think
you need to replenish your aging hormones.
Yeah.
Right? Let's leave it like that.
And that would sell because we're all desperate to look younger and feel younger.
Just have to work hard in the gym, really.
Yeah, but this is an easy way out, isn't it?
Right. Be very cautious. My message is to the listeners out there is to be very cautious when you
when introduced to this idea, because in life there's really hardly any shortcuts, really, especially when it comes to health. Why gamble the risk of your own life and your own health with just to look a bit younger? Right? Just get hit the gym.
Even if you're not, even if it doesn't cause death, Dr. Zanaria, yeah. what are the possible consequences?
As I mentioned just now, you can become a little bit hyperthyroid because most instances it's on the other side.
Right, so you crank up the battery.
And the consequence of that would
be... Your heart will beat faster. Yes. You might not be able to take it if you have cardiac arrhythmia. And then, you know, you might lose weight too fast and your absorptions of, you know, nutrition and things like that might be too much. Yeah.
But you see, that's what you want.
And the individual...
But might be crank up too much.
Yeah. Okay.
The individual tend to feel a bit more energetic, you know, so that...
And when you crank it up too much, what happens?
In the worst case scenario, you get thyroid toxicosis. That's when your eye's about to pop out.
Which is what? Thyroid poisoning?
That's right.
We won't use that word. It won't go frankly towards thyroid toxicosis because probably the amounts used are very small.
Tiny.
Yeah. But I think the risk of having heart rhythm abnormalities, so your heart rate can get a bit irregular or fast. And the other issue that's unaddressed is probably the rate of bone loss, especially for women, can be accelerated.
Bone loss, okay.
And that promotes osteoporosis. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Why are women more prone to hypothyroidism?
That's right. You know, I'm quite keen to do that.
Yeah. Most statistics would say, as George said, you know, 8 to 1 more women getting thyroid disease.
So unfair.
Compared to men.
Very unfair, George. Thanks for being very considerate.
That's right. Eight times, right? That we're talking about eight times.
It goes both for hypo and hyperthyroidism, and it's probably due to the predisposition to autoimmune disease, where you get production of antibodies by your immune system, and the trigger is your own thyroid tissue. And this could either stimulate your thyroid to produce more hormones, then you get what we call thyrotoxicosis, too much hormone. But when we're focusing on hypothyroidism, you get these antibodies that actually destroy the thyroid follicular cells, cause inflammation and loss of the cells, and therefore the ability to produce hormone is lost. And usually what happens is the gland starts to shrink with time. You know?
So, I mean, is it fair? So what you're saying is that hypothyroidism, women are more prone to it.
Yes.
And then hyper, women are more prone
also,
to it. What about cancer?
Also, yes, I believe
so.
The most common thyroid cancers are... You know, papillary and follicular thyroid cancers, and certainly they're much more common in women than men.
Okay, and does being hypo or hyper lead to cancer?
Not directly, but some situations where you get hypothyroidism due to thyroiditis, there can be higher rates of a different type of cancer called lymphoma. Sometimes, but generally no, they're quite separate.
Okay. Let's talk about the pregnant woman and the pregnant woman who has hypothyroidism. We're quite concerned about that.
So does pregnancy predispose somebody to you know, hypothyroidism?
Pregnancy per se, well, when you're pregnant, what happens is the placenta produces this hormone called HCG, and HCG has a effect like TSH, which is thyroid stimulating hormone. So what happens is there is sort of a mild hyperthyroid state in the early part of pregnancy.
Okay. So that's quite physiological.
Yeah. And sometimes it's not manifest, but in some women it does manifest, you know. So you measure the levels and the levels are high. And in fact, the levels of thyroid hormone in pregnancy are actually higher in general, they're non-pregnant, and we should accept that. And most doctors acknowledge that. So you don't tend to over-diagnose hyperthyroidism in pregnancy because it would generally be a little bit high, and it gets towards normal as the pregnancy sort of ends.
Okay. So, talking about the levels, right?
Yeah.
It's a blood test?
It's a blood test.
Okay. You have... And which standards are we following? Apparently the British have a standard, the US has a standard, so which one are we, do we...
All right. When you say standard, maybe you refer
levels,
to the
level,
the
acceptable
points?
Levels, yeah.
The reference
range. Yeah, the reference range. Well, we tend to follow the American Thyroid Association, or most of the time it's quite acceptable or universal.
Is there a big difference between Asians and Caucasians, for example?
I don't think we have enough data to support that. So even in Asia,
we
tend
just
to
follow
use the same,
Caucasian,
the cutoff points. Yeah,
and that's accurate enough.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah.
Okay, all right then. And let's look at the type 2 diabetes.
I'm interested, right? Okay, so early on, we say, you know, 12%, Americans say 12% of the general population will have thyroid problem, and 60% of them are unaware of that. If so many people are unaware of something that is not so life-threatening in some way, is it really important to have a day of awareness to say that? Because can people just be blissfully be happy that they're hypothyroid or slightly hyperthyroid? And then, you know, and also with so many links with diabetes, obesities and things like that, what causes what? Is it because you're obese and it causes hypothyroid, or is it because your diabetes that it actually induces your you know, your thyroid to be less active? I'm quite keen on your opinion on that.
Or does hypothyroidism lead to
which one, chicken
diabetes?
And egg situation, right? So let's answer the first question first, right? You know, if the vast majority of people are blissfully unaware, are we creating with these kind of like campaign, you know, all the skeptics out there and say, are we creating, you know, too much awareness?
And also, we have the largest number of diabetics in Southeast Asia. So does that mean our thyroids are going to be compromised eventually?
Well, I think awareness so importantly has to be among women in their reproductive age, because if you're going to conceive, you need to know that your thyroid status is fine. And in pregnancy, you should also know if you have a predisposition to have thyroid disease, a family history, a previous bout of thyroid disease, then, you know, you really should be aware that their problems can crop up. And even in the postpartum period, there's this condition called postpartum thyroiditis, which is actually quite linked to postpartum depression. Often under-recognized, and women can suffer, you know, in this period. So essentially, I think among women in the reproductive age, I think it's really important to know about different thyroid disease.
Good point. Because, you know, if you have been trying to get pregnant, and then if it's simple things of tweaking your thyroid hormone is the solutions, you know, clearly it's important. But are we talking about big groups of people? I mean, clearly you mentioned a very important group of people might be affected by, you know, thyroid conditions. But the vast majority of the population who are unaware, what sort of, you know, demographic are they?
As I said, we're really focusing on women. And the other age group I think we have to focus on is the elderly women. Yeah, still women as well. There was a debate before about what we call universal screening of all pregnant women for thyroid disease.
Okay.
And that was maybe some time ago.
Do we do it?
No, we don't. So what we do is opportunistic. Okay. So we would actually go through a series of questions looking at the risks of developing thyroid disease, then only screening. But once before, there was a debate saying that, you know, if hypothyroidism is unrecognized in pregnancy and that can lead to poor, you know, IQ and neurocognitive problems in the fetus, then we should actually be, you know, screening women for thyroid disease so that, you know, you'll have the optimal outcome of the offspring.
And also, if you say, you know, people, women who suffer depression postpartum, then that could lead to hypothyroidism as well. Or is it the hypothyroidism that leads to the depression?
It is usually it may be linked or may not be linked, but in women with postpartum depression, I think their thyroid function should be actually measured and assessed.
Okay, so it's before, it's during pregnancy, and it's post and that it really needs to be watched.
So that's a very important group of people that need to be aware
but
of.
But we're also a bit concerned that, you know, there'll be a rush of sort of measuring thyroid hormones.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking, right? So everyone's now going to go out and get their thyroid which may be a good thing, don't you think?
But, you know, but yet some people might say it might be overdiagnosing.
Yeah. So to recognize certain risk factors would be probably important. And very importantly is a family occurrence of thyroid disease.
Yeah. Okay then. LTY, how are you?
Fine. Good afternoon, Mira.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Your
good
question.
Good afternoon, Dr. George.
Yeah, hello,
LTY. Good afternoon, Dr. Zunaida. Eh?
Zanaria.
How are you all? Okay.
Very well. Good.
Okay, I have two questions for you, all right? First, can hyper and hypo thyroidism affect our sleep, all right? This is very common in elderly people. My second question is this. Is there any link between the thyroid and the pineal gland? You know where's the pineal gland? You are at the pineal gland is at the back of our brain, at the center back of our brain, and this is responsible for the production of melatonin that control our biological
okay. That's very kind.
Is there a link? Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, LTY.
Let's deal with the first question first. Sleep. You know, hyper, will people sleep more
sometimes
or sleep less?
LTY forgets that we have doctors in the studio.
So do you know that?
But thank you. You've got to love him for that.
It's always delightful to hear
yes,
from LTY.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for calling LTY. Yes, does it affect sleep?
Certainly. I mean, if you are hyperthyroid, there's a tendency to have insomnia and difficulty to sleep. And the reverse with hypothyroidism.
You just sleep a lot.
You tend to have somnolence. So even in the daytime, you tend to be a bit sleepy. But those are really extremes when your hormones are really high and really low. And most of the time when you're somewhere in between or you're treated well for either condition, you should not have any sleep difficulties.
Okay, so with thyroxine, there's a high chance it will get it will sort the problem out.
Get diagnosed first. If it's replaced well.
Okay.
You should sort it out.
Replaced well.
Replaced well. Yeah, okay.
What does that mean? But we'll come back to that.
Right.
Replaced well. I'm putting that down here. I'm coming back because we have a question here from Yong who's saying her younger sister had her thyroid removed. Mm. Is it really necessary?
Okay, we're going to talk about thyroidectomy, later on.
Yep. Go ahead.
I mean, obviously, I read in some statistics that in the US, 130,000 thyroidectomies has been done.
Right.
I mean, clearly, they cannot all be for cancers, right? Mm. Okay. So, is that necessary? Many people ask that question. Early on, you mentioned about, iodine treatment. You mentioned about medications and surgery. So, is the surgery necessary? It's what Yong wants to know.
Right. I think things have changed. In the past, you have a goiter and, you may end up having thyroid surgery because, of course, there might be a concern that the goiter is associated with a tumour, whether it's a benign tumour or a cancer. Or also, if your thyroid is overfunctioning, it was well accepted then that you remove the whole gland if it's hyperfunctioning. But now it's a bit different because when patients have thyroid surgery, it's predominantly due to thyroid cancer. Less and less surgery is being done for an overactive thyroid gland because most of the time we have access to radioactive iodine therapy. So thyroid surgery is mainly done for thyroid cancer today. The development is that in the past, it used to be a total thyroidectomy for thyroid cancers. But now we understand as we are picking up thyroid cancers earlier because we are able to do certain tests on nodules that we pick up and we can pick up early disease. So there is a role for actually a limited kind of thyroid surgery when the stage of disease is limited.
Do you know why in America there's so many has been done and they're anticipating 30% increase within a year? It's like, I just find that mind-boggling.
But their rate is 12%, George, compared to us. That's only 2 to 3%.
Thyroid cancer is a common cancer. And usually if you diagnose thyroid cancer and there's already evidence of,
metastasis,
lymph nodes and metastasis, you do have to remove the whole thyroid and follow it up with what we call radioactive iodine therapy.
Okay. So coming back to the question as to whether or not it's necessary, what are some pertinent questions you should ask your doctor if, in fact, it is suggested that you remove the organ? What should we be asking?
Usually it's in the situation of having what we call a nodule that's picked up. Yeah, because it is obvious or it's causing symptoms in the neck and it's actually confirmed by imaging or ultrasound. The doctor has done what we call a needle biopsy and there are results to discuss with the patient.
Okay.
And based on those results, then the issue of whether you need to do a thyroidectomy.
Okay. So nothing to do with hypo or hyper?
No.
This is
more cancer.
Okay. Yeah, usually it's
that sort of scenario.
Okay, sure. We'll come back. We're discussing your thyroid and its function and ways to manage hypothyroidism or hyperthyroidism. Give us a call. The number is 0377-109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 016-201-9000. We'll be back right after the market update on BFM 89.9.
Doctor in the House, brought to you by AIA Vitality.
Good afternoon. It's Health and Living. It's our Doctor in the House show. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, in the studio with us. And we have also Dr. Zunaria Hussain, a consultant endocrinologist. She's also president of the Malaysian Endocrine and Metabolic Society. We are discussing your thyroid, which is a butterfly-shaped organ in the front of your neck. And it sort of it releases hormones that affect your metabolism and influences a host of your body functions. Now, did I just read that out really well and convincingly?
Absolutely.
I know exactly what I'm saying.
It's like off her tongue. You know? She's done this for so long. She knows it all.
Right. It's written here, George. Rest assured. Just to quickly, before we end the show, you spoke about how thyroxine or the medication, your thyroid, needs to be replaced well.
Okay.
What does that mean?
That is in the context of having too little thyroid hormone or hypothyroidism. So we use thyroxine tablets, synthetic thyroid hormone, and generally we need to sort of adjust it to the right dose so that you get the right levels of thyroid hormone. So your doctors would actually start on a dose and then within a few weeks or a couple of months, check your hormone level and adjust it as time goes by. And usually, once you get to the right dose, you do not have to change the dose. Most of the time, thyroxine replacement is lifelong.
I was about
permanent.
To ask you, because Malaysians are such, as long as anything is lifelong, they don't want to take it. Whether it's high blood pressure medication or whether it's diabetes.
But this one is that when you don't take it, actually you feel a bit lousy. So you will know whether your dose is right or not. But the patient themselves will know.
So for us, it's really important to replace just enough, not over-replacement and not under-replacement.
Can we ever achieve what nature intended?
It's difficult because if you look at audits here and there in most clinics, about only half of the people that are on the thyroxine hormone are really optimally controlled. The other quarter is too over-replaced and the other quarter is under-replaced. So it is tough. It's tough.
Is it a failure of the doctors or?
Both ways, probably. Actually.
For doctors, because you need to observe the patient a lot more and then more blood tests. And patient compliance probably plays
That's
a bit
true.
Of a role.
Compliance, even taking it at different times of the day with food or without food makes a difference to the absorption of the drug.
Because imagine this is how nature intended constant release of this hormone and suddenly you just had a peak and trough or using ingested medication.
My goodness, compliance is another session altogether. We can talk about it to death.
Right.
So now we know compliance is extremely crucial. Elderly people seem to be at higher risk of hypothyroidism as well. Is there a reason for that?
As I mentioned, all organs tend to sort of, go
down.
But, it's a physiological thing. And you know that your hormone levels are different as you age, and I think that's natural.
Is it important to diagnose older people who has got these pathological thyroid deficiency?
Yeah. Very important because in the elderly, hypothyroidism or hyperthyroidism, in fact, may present differently. Not with the typical classical symptoms you and I know, but actually the impact is on the heart. So that's really important. Thyroid and the heart is something we've got to focus in the elderly. They can present with heart failure. They can have a predisposition to heart attacks by way of having high cholesterol. Hypothyroidism will cause high cholesterol because breakdown of cholesterol is affected because metabolism is low. So we have had instances where we've got patients with hypothyroidism having cholesterols up to 10. And you got to actually treat the hypothyroidism so the cholesterol will come down.
George, I don't want to grow old.
Neither do I, but I've got about 200 years to go.
No worries, Mira.
It's okay. We'll go
it's
for this.
It's usually not extreme.
Still, it all sounds going downhill.
It's okay. We'll just keep our thyroid happy. That's all.
How do you keep the thyroid happy?
You know, so because you mentioned about iodine, right? Okay, right. Which is the whole iodine hormones. Obviously, there's certain food that a lot of food contains iodine. That's right. Yeah, goitrogenic. Yeah. So, can you explain to the listeners a little bit about what food to avoid?
Kerang.
Kerang. That's it. Goitrogenic.
So, I think the goiter incidents of large goiters were actually associated with iodine deficiency, usually when people lived in the mountainous areas and deep inland. And by right, in our country, where we're actually, you know, mostly close to the sea and having a lot of seafood, we shouldn't have iodine deficiency. Mm-hmm. And looking at the, you know, statistics, we found that iodine deficiency only really there in the East Malaysia, in Sabah and Sarawak, in the interiors, and they have actually replaced iodine. So, you know, endemic iodine deficient goiters are actually very much less now compared to those
days. Can we be overloaded with iodine? Too much?
Too much, possibly, but I don't see it as a problem nowadays. You know, having food that are goitrogenic, even certain vegetables, you know, that have high iodine and goitrogenic, you know, I don't see it such a problem nowadays, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's nothing really much I can do besides...
to keep your...
So when it turns about food, you know, can your, you know...
keep touching your neck.
Sort of restriction or
that is
taking
mean
too much of food. Yeah. There is something about selenium and thyroid.
Okay,
actually.
Do explain about selenium, because people talk about selenium and fertility and
so
also
it's a big bag that I don't want to open actually.
What is selenium and what food contains selenium?
Selenium as a mineral has been found to be good for, I think, thyrotoxicosis and thyroid eye disease, so supplementing that. Other than that, I'm not too sure.
You're not too sure what food is rich in it. Just go to a health food store and get it for selenium.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, early on we talked about diabetes, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I always get this situation. People say, nah, my situation is, you know, it's thyroid that's causing it. Can diabetes induce, you know, because they're closely linked, right? You know, diabetes and hypothyroid and obesity and a hypothyroid. Which one is this a chicken and egg situation? What causes what?
Well, the simpler understanding is that if you have too much thyroid hormone, what happens is your insulin doesn't work well. So, in fact, you have a very extreme hyperthyroidism. You can have a tendency to get hyperglycemia, high glucose. But then, on the other hand, recent studies have shown that if you are actually having hypothyroidism, is also a state of when your insulin is not working well or insulin resistance and does predispose to pre-diabetes and diabetes. And these are the recent studies that have been published in the US, in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think, recently.
Yeah. Okay.
So it seems that it's very difficult to understand because if you have hypo and also if you have hyper, there's still a risk of diabetes. And in fact, the risk of diabetes is prevalent everywhere.
Yeah, it looks like Malaysian Endocrinological and Metabolic Society have a lot on your plates, really, to deal with, right? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you guys doing these days that actually is promoting endocrinological health over the nation?
So I'm glad to say with our campaign on raising awareness of thyroid disease, collaborating with MOH and with Merck, the other thing we've done is we've actually worked together with the other subspecialists in developing a consensus guideline to treating thyroid cancer that was actually published and last year. And this year, we've taken the initiative to come together to also in towards improving quality of care for thyroid patients is developing a thyroid management clinical practice guideline. And also, I mentioned to you, is the commitment to research that we have, funding the nationwide thyroid prevalence study research.
Okay.
And,
fantastic. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
My takeaway is really, if two-thirds of us are walking around not knowing our thyroid levels, then maybe go get it checked out. And women in particular.
Okay. Yeah.
In
so
your
forget
productive,
about men this time.
Yeah, in your productive years, you may want to go get yourself checked out.
Right.
And also elderly, you know, if you are, you know, just not quite right, your health wise, maybe worthwhile checked as well, right?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us today. That was Dr. Zanaria Hussain, consultant endocrinologist. Up next, George and I are going to be talking about if you are tempted to hit a pause on your daily routine, which is your exercise routine, for a little, just to rest and you get a little complacent, you're going to pay for it. That's coming up after this on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, it's Health and Living. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, in the studio with me, and we are going to bring you some information from menshealth.com.
That's right.
There's an article that caught my eye, especially for the men, and it says if you are tempted to actually take a break from your daily routine for a little recharge, you may want to rethink that strategy, George.
Yes, I mean, I knew it. I was like, this is the early research presented in the European Congress, right?
Yes.
Basically about obesity, right? 2 weeks of drastically reducing your physical activity can hurt your body because even 2 weeks itself, right? They're looking at 28 physically active young adults, average, 10,000 steps per day. You just tell them, look, stop it, reduce it to 80%, so down to about, 1,500 steps a day. Suddenly, everything goes haywire.
Mm-hmm.
So do you believe that? It's like, I do believe, I feel it now. Now
yep.
I can be on this kind of like momentum.
I know you've started exercising.
That's
but
right.
Let me tell you, I'm sure it doesn't need 2 weeks. Just missing a couple of days makes you feel rather, like you're missing out on something.
So you lose
it?
That momentum. Once you lose that momentum, you might lose it forever.
Okay.
And then the weight will gain. And this is a research that proves it. Don't you think this is kind of quite, it's just quite sensible?
Yes, so just 2 weeks of laying off and coming down to 1,500 steps from the 10,000 that they usually do, they gained quite a lot of body weight, actually.
A pound of total weight, at least a loss about 0.8 pounds of muscle mass,
mm-hmm.
and in 2 weeks' time. And I think that's quite significant because they also see increase in waist size. Okay, 2 weeks is probably too soon to tell, but what is important is this central fat percentage, because with Dr. Azani, we talked a lot about TG level, central fat, and this is what they measure.
Yep. And so when you lose muscle mass, you can raise your diabetes risk as well. So it can make you less sensitive to insulin is what the research is saying. However, there are some reservations in that this wasn't carried out amongst men who were very, very active in the gym. These were just normal individuals who had some kind of a routine. But so they may actually have some sort of reserves if they are actually very, very their baseline levels.
I agree. I mean, people will just say, hang on a minute, this is 28 physically active young men.
Yeah.
But the thing is that what it tells you is that, during the Ramadan months, if you want to take a break and say, look, since you're fasting, take it easy. And don't do that, because a bit of enthusiasm and a bit of momentum mm-hmm. will carry a long, long way.
I mean, you can book up also and continue with the regime.
Yeah. That's right.
I do know still see Muslims coming in to continue their workout. But really depends on you and how fit you really are.
It's a good workout to do, and then that will keep the momentum going and will keep the fat away.
Okay, so Ramadan Mubarak to all of you who are going to start fasting tomorrow.
Absolutely. Well, wish we all peaceful Ramadan, and go easy on those buka puasa.
Yes, thank you for joining me today, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Doctor in the House was brought to you by AIA Vitality, a health program that rewards your health.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.